At some signal from Wheaton, the landlord refilled the glasses, filling Mr. Poots to the brim, and proclaimed a loud welcome to Martha Wheaton's new young friend. Hugh walked away satisfied, wondering only how he might explain to Aunt Agatha why Daniel would need to miss lunch and lie down all afternoon. In the green banqueting hall, Agatha Kent watched hopelessly as Beatrice Nash gave a good account of her qualifications, her extensive travels, and her experience to a table filled with men who mostly did not care. The headmaster had the grace to look uncomfortable, making copious notes on a paper and fiddling with his collar. The vicar looked earnestly pious, but his eyelids were drowsy, and he was obviously smiling not at Miss Nash, but at a mental picture of his lunch to come. Emily Wheaton was just now glaring at Mr. Satchel, the shipowner, who was whispering to Farmer Bowen. The farmer who owned large acreage from sheep pasture on the marsh to hop fields towards the Kent border, wore his best wool suit and polished boots, and as usual this time of year he was at the meeting to make sure the school would remain closed for the full period of the hop harvest, and otherwise to vote as the mayor wished him to do. Mr. Satchel was very interested in the educational efforts of the school, looking as he was for a steady supply of young clerks for his maritime warehouses. He could usually be persuaded to support new efforts and ideas. But he was immune to the social inducements of Emily Wheaton, so his support for Beatrice was uncertain. Mr. Arnold Pike was Artie Pike's uncle. He was a tight-fisted man and suspicious of all change, as if it were somehow designed to strip him of his worldly position. Agatha thought this might be the result of a pricking conscience. He had benefited from the disinheritance of his older brother, Cedric, because their chapel father had not approved of Cedric's weakness for the occasional tipple. Now Cedric worked in the ironmongery on a store clerk's salary and could not reliably afford his son's school fees. Agatha and John's little scholarships were supposed to be confidential, but sometimes she thought Arnold Pike glared at her with even more suspicion than usual. "I believe Miss Nash is not only fully qualified to teach Latin, but has even had some work of Latin translation published," said Agatha, trying to encourage the room at large. She had received a note from Hugh asking her to extend the interview as long as possible, but the frowns around the table did not inspire confidence. "Just a couple of short Herodotus poems, published in a literary magazine in California," said Beatrice. "And I also created a third poem, in a similar style as a commentary on the original content, and to display its connections to events of our own times," she added.
"Whoever heard of making up new Latin on top of what already exists?" said Mr. Satchel, looking comically alarmed. "I had enough old Latin beaten into me without trying to expand the stuff."
He stuck an elbow in Farmer Bowen's ribs, and they both chuckled.
"I am sure Miss Nash understands what an effort it is to get our young men to memorize the usual passages of translation," said the headmaster. "We did terribly in last year's scholarship exams, and so we must be sure not to waste a moment trying anything too innovative this coming year." "Repetitio est mater studiorum," said the vicar, who could not resist speaking Latin in the deep tone that he used for projecting sermons to the farthest reaches of St. Mary's Church.
"Hear, hear,"
said Farmer Bowen, to cover the fact that he had no Latin whatsoever. "I absolutely agree that repetition is the mother of all studies," said Beatrice Nash in a firm tone, "but I do find that the more ways one can vary the necessary practice, the more one can commit to memory not just the text, but the story and the meaning."
"What we need is a master who will not spare the rod," said Mr. Pike. "These boys must forget stories and games and bend their backs into hard work if they're to acquire a respectable trade."
"Well spoken, Mr. Pike," said the mayor.
"I'm sure Miss Nash is more than able to wield a cane to suitable effect," said Lady Emily. "Do you play tennis, Miss Nash?"
"Tennis?" asked Beatrice. She looked bewildered, and Agatha sighed. She was used to the very different paths of logic by which her fellow board members pursued their thoughts. but she realized now that to an outsider the exchange must seem like a chapter from Alice in Wonderland.
"It's all in the wrist," said Lady Emily.
"I do all the serious caning myself," said the headmaster. "I find it adds to the gravity to have the offending child take the long walk to my office. They are usually quite cowed by the time they see me."
"I understand that you would also like to increase proficiency in Euclidean geometry?" asked Beatrice. "I have pursued advanced studies in both geometry and the newest algebraic theories." They looked at her as if she had offered to demonstrate fire-eating. It seemed to Agatha that Beatrice now gave up the fight. Her shoulders seemed to slump, and she folded her hands in her lap.
"We are delighted in all your proficiencies," said Agatha. "I believe we can let Miss Nash escape now."
They agreed, and as Beatrice left the room, Agatha looked over at Emily Wheaton, who was rigid with fury, but who gave a small shake of the head. Agatha feared they were defeated.
"Could we ask Mr. Poot to come in now?" said the headmaster to the girl who was holding the door for Beatrice. "If my wife understood mathematics, maybe she'd keep tighter accounts, and not be asking me for dress money every year," said Mr. Pike.
"Perish the thought, man," said Mr. Satchel. "I'd rather show my books to the excise man."
Mr. Poot sat very stiff on the upright chair and fixed his gaze carefully, it seemed, on the mayor's moving lips.
"Not because he's my nephew, of course," the mayor concluded after a long and enthusiastic summing up of Mr. Poot's career.
In the mayor's telling, the man was something of a legend, thought Agatha.
"But we would also be getting the benefit of his legal experience, and I believe he would be a figure our boys could look up to."
"We have girls as well, Mr. Fothergill," said Agatha.
"One or two, but they do not count in this case," said the mayor. "They cannot aspire to a legal career, whereas we may have several future clerks among our boys."
"Mr. Poot, may we inquire further about your wish to exchange the law for teaching?" asked Lady Emily. "What propels you into academia?"
The young man swiveled his head towards her voice and opened his mouth to reply, but his head appeared to continue to revolve past her, and as slowly as in a dream, Mr. Poot toppled off his chair and lay in an inert heap on the carpet.
"Well, I imagine that had something to do with it," said Agatha.
With neither the heart to hope, nor the energy to repack her possessions, Beatrice Nash sat with a book open on her lap. She had, however, forgotten her reading, and was instead engaged in the important task of staring at a small brown spider, which was constructing a lopsided web in the lower corner of the cottage's front window. The spider seemed to lose its footing often, and would drop, hanging from its trailing silk and tangling the lines, like an old lady dropping stitches in her knitting. Beatrice wondered how far the world extended for the spider. Did it have a warm spot in the garden to soak up the sun, or was its life circumscribed by the rough oak window frame and a small, dark hole in the painted sill? If it were accidentally dropped into a trunk and transported by ship to the wilds of South America, would it notice, or would it just find another sill, another hole? And would the flicking tongue of a predatory lizard be no more a threat than Abigail's broom? Wishing to expand the spider's options in life, she caught up a portion of web and spider on the edge of her book and opened the stiff iron catch of the window to shake him out onto the street. Shouted calls and the scrape of a horse's shoe on the cobbles made her lean out to look down the steep hill. A farm cart was coming up the narrow street. The straining horse coaxed not just by the farmer driving, but by a boy walking at its head, while other people pushed from behind. The car contained a stack of objects wrapped and roped to such a dizzying height that it looked like some strange circus wagon. On top of the heap, she could see Daniel, standing like a charioteer, whistling a jaunty, martial tune and twirling a broad straw hat.
"You're not actually helping," came a voice, the narrow houses amplifying and projecting the sound towards her.
She saw it was Hugh, pushing behind the near side back wheel.
"I'm directing the triumphant approach," said Daniel.
"'One more push up the middle there, sir!'
The farmer gave a crack of his whip, and the cart lurched forward, the load shifting dangerously backward and left. Daniel whooped, but grabbed for a rope to steady himself, and the boy at the horse's head had to step nimbly aside as horse and wooden shafts thrust forward.
"'Do be careful,' said Hugh. "'I said we should have done it in two loads.' "'Where's the triumph in that?' said Daniel. "'This is an arrival.'
"'This is a spectacle,' said Hugh, raising his hat to three ladies who had wedged themselves into a doorway in fear. The spectacle was increased by the blast of a car horn as Agatha Kent's car made the turn at the top of the lane and nosed down to the cottage. The horse gave a loud whinny and backed slightly before being wrestled to a stop. The car parked directly outside Beatrice's window and revealed Agatha Kent, sitting amid a pile of brown paper parcels and a bouquet of roses. Jenny the maid was squashed into the rumble seat, clutching a quantity of mops and brooms, and from his perch on the running board, an aproned shop boy sprang down to haul a huge basket from the front seat. Agatha waved as Smith ran around the car to open her door, and Beatrice experienced a momentary desire to slam the window and flee into the back alley as she realized the spectacle was coming to her door.
"'We are come with all the spoils of victory,' said Agatha, speaking through the window.
She waved Jenny and the shop boy towards the front door, adding, "'Do let's get inside before we disturb all the neighbours.'
"'I don't understand,' said Beatrice.
"'The position is yours, my dear,' said Agatha.
"'But I thought,' Beatrice began.
"'A mere formality, as I had supposed,' said Agatha. "'Now, Hugh, do have them take great care with those bookcases. They were my mother's.'
Beatrice could only stand back in shock as the procession came into the tiny parlour, first Abigail carrying the shop basket, then Jenny and her mops, the farmer and his boy carrying a bookcase, and Agatha ducking her hat under the doorframe and filling the room with the scent of pink roses.
"'Is it true?' asked Beatrice. "'I thought for sure Mr. Poot would be chosen.'
"'Mr. Poot proved himself an unsteady candidate, shall we say?'
said Daniel, coming into the crowded space carrying a stiff-backed chair.
"'We shall not,' said Agatha in a reproving tone.
"'Do go through to the kitchen, Jenny, and get those few things put away. The bookcase is either side of the fireplace, I think, don't you, Miss Nash?'
"'Oh, and these are for you, from the garden. Do you have a vase?'
Chapter 7 Her bicycle had reached a speed at which its wheels seemed to spin without effort. The dirt road thrummed beneath her, and a breeze of her own making refreshed her face and kept her cool even as she pumped her legs faster, boots pressed to the hard rubber pedals. Out here on the marsh, there seemed to be no other person in the world, only the flutter of white butterflies among the nodding meadows sweet, and tall grasses that edged the green and weedy ditches. The very day seemed to dance within her, and Beatrice Nash hitched her blue serge skirts higher and let out a whoop of joy to have the whole day to herself. To be established for a week now in a freshly scrubbed cottage, to be in possession of paying work, and to have found congenial acquaintances while being under no one's direction, seemed to Beatrice fortunate indeed. Even when school began, she thought, there would be both the satisfaction of noble vocation and evenings free for reading and writing. And today, she was a real writer. Her book was on its way to Mr. Carraway, her father's publisher, and she rode out of town with all the confidence that comes to a writer from having wrapped a finished work in several sheets of stout brown paper, secured it with strong twine and red sealing wax, and handed it in to the man in the post office. On such a fair day, the summer bank holiday, Beatrice was inclined to be generous even towards the dark shadow of Mrs. Turber. That very morning, there had been a pursed-lipped negotiation over the beef sandwich, now in Beatrice's bicycle basket. It was Mrs. Turber's routine, and apparently much praised by the prior lodger to provide a substantial noontime dinner and a cold supper at night. Evening dinner was offered only on Saturday nights, and a glass of wine provided along with the best china. It was hardly decent, she said, to expect her to provide portable cold lunches, nor would a lady of Mrs. Turber's standing be caught eating such a lunch alone along a public road somewhere. Beatrice had pleaded summer weather and asked for a simple plate of dinner to be reheated and served on a tray in the evenings. Mrs. Turber had grudgingly called for Abigail to make the sandwich, but she continued to sniff her disapproval, and only a gleam in the eye betrayed a possible satisfaction that a widow could be forgiven for pocketing some small savings from this arrangement. Breathing the fresh air of the fields and basking in the sun, Beatrice laughed aloud and vowed to treat the widow with such resolute and kindly respect that her landlady's crusty air of suffering must eventually give way. She followed the ribbons of country lanes across vast fields of corn and rye, through coppiced woods and down the brief streets of thatch-roofed hamlets. She lost track of time, and the sun was over her shoulder before she thought to take stock of her location. Coasting to a stop at a crossroads, she looked about to fix her direction. Without the clatter of her wheels, the world seemed to fall into silence. It was so still, she could hear the slight rustle of dry corn in the field, and the lumbering buzz of a fat bee somewhere on the far side of a thorny hedge. No voice or sound of human occupation broke across the sleeping fields. She had travelled further than she had meant, but climbing onto the lower rungs of a five-bar gate, she looked across the marsh and was pleased to see the very top of Rise Hill, just the church tower and a couple of rooftops, peeking above the plain. The coast lay to her south, and the curving bluff of the Sussex Downs formed a continuous wall to the north. Above her head, the sky was clear of clouds and seemed to enclose the marsh in a protective blue bowl. There was, she reasoned, no way to be lost. She would eat her picnic and then just meander home, keeping always to the west, until she found herself on familiar pathways. As she ate and drank from a glass bottle of water that was still cold to the touch, Beatrice reflected that Mrs. Turber's fare might be meagre, but that, like all food, it was greatly improved by being eaten outdoors. Fleeting images of other picnics asked to be remembered, and she held them in trembling stillness, waiting for the sudden stab like that of a toothache, which too often came from remembering her father. No clutch of pain came, and so she allowed, tentatively, the memory of freshly caught fish, cooked on an apparatus of sticks by a large bonfire on a California beach. Her father and two other professors, poking the fish with their knives and telling stories as if they were rough backwoodsmen rather than soft-handed academics with gracious front porches on a leafy campus and tenure. Their wives unpacked pies from towel-lined baskets and passed cold flagons of birch beer and lemonade, and she, next to her father, her back tucked against a warm boulder, was free to listen and to turn her face alternately from the warmth of the fire to the dark, eternal crashing of the ocean surf. A smaller picnic came to her, just the two of them and a slow walk away from the musk of the sick room, up a grassy avenue of giant elms, like a green cathedral, to a stile looking over a valley of neat hedged fields. She had asked the kitchen for two soft bread rolls and hot chicken soup, in one of Lord Marbley's new-fangled thermos flasks, and had slipped into his study to fill her father's hip flask with brandy. She remembered a childlike urge to get her father out of the house, away from the dour private nurse. The walk had been painfully slow, her father's breathing labored and her own urgency becoming a frustration. She remembered a sudden feeling of anger towards him, as if it were his fault that the sun and breeze did not restore him, and a swift shame in the recognition of her own selfish desire not to have to endure his decline. They settled on the step of the stile, and her father sipped soup, laced with brandy, from a metal cup held in shaky hands. He pronounced it nectar, though he could not drink more than half a cup, and she finished it while he looked at the veil below with the unblinking stare of a statue. She grew frightened and laid a hand on his to call him back to her. "Father?" He responded with a wavering smile and lifted his arm with difficulty to wave at the view as he quoted, "Happy the man whose wish and care, a few paternal acres bound, content to breathe his native air in his own ground." It had been their game and a favourite parlour trick since her early childhood for him to startle her with lines of poetry and demand citation. She could remember many social evenings where she had been suddenly called upon and much fussed over by ladies who thought her a clever little monkey. "Alexander Pope, Ode to Solitude," she said quietly. She knew they were both seeing the poem in their heads. Neither of them quoted from the final stanza. "Thus unlamented, let me die." "Of course, he quite borrowed the thought from old Horace," her father said, and it was then that she sank to her knees and hid her tearful face in his lap. Had her father been Catholic, she was quite sure he would have critiqued the priest during the last rites. He had left with the solicitors a list of hymns and readings for his funeral. However, the list was simply obscure lines from each, and there was a note to ask Beatrice. She smiled to remember Aunt Marbley's growing apoplexy as the selections, each piece more unsuitable than the last, were slowly revealed. She stood up and shook out her napkin, determined not to spoil such a lovely day with angry tears. As she collected her bicycle, the thought came, unbidden, that she might entertain Agatha and her nephews with this story of her father's last instructions. That Beatrice Nash should have new friends with which to share such amusing anecdotes was such a novel idea that she laughed aloud and startled a rabbit from the hedge. An hour or more later, she had circled back to the very same crossroads. She could see the gate and the dent in the grass where she had sat to enjoy her picnic. She was tired now and thirsty from Mrs. Turber's salty beef. The marsh, so flat and open to the horizon, had transformed itself into an impenetrable maze of crooked lanes and dikes with no bridges. In the fields, sheep shaved the grass with their black lips and looked at her with sly eyes. She could now understand how smugglers in centuries past had managed to elude the excise men over this seemingly simple landscape. Taking a deep breath to quell a rush of anxiety, Beatrice decided not to force her way west, but to ride north, towards the bluffs where she remembered the canal and its road, built to defeat Napoleon, which would take her home to Rye. Hugh had told her about the canal, and as she remembered sensible Hugh, she took heart and set off once again with renewed determination. Fear is a great spur to endeavour, and when Beatrice at last slowed her pace, she had covered some miles, and the canal and the main road were just before her. The dark line of trees and cliff welcome after the flat heat of the marsh. Unfortunately, the slackening of velocity revealed a trembling in her exhausted limbs. Just before the junction where the lane crossed a small bridge to meet the main road, the bicycle gave a large wobble side to side, and then, with the front wheel catching on the dry, rutted surface, it tumbled Beatrice sideways into a bramble-filled ditch, catching her right ankle a severe blow as it fell on top of her. She lay very still, thinking only that the ditch felt dry and that this was a blessing. The herbal scents of crushed weeds and the woody smell of warm blackberry brambles were thick around her head, and the sunlight was pleasantly fractured and dappled by the canopy of a tree. Rubbing at a small trickle of blood on her neck from a bramble scratch, she searched her pocket, glad once more to be carrying one of her father's sensible handkerchiefs in place of the cambric scraps usually favoured by young ladies. A woodpigeon, always the cello in the orchestra of birdsong, gave out its low double coo from the shade. But for the throb, like a beat from a large drum, which began to vibrate in her right ankle, she thought it would have been very pleasant just to lie there. Hugh was conscious of the need to keep the horse and trap going at a smart pace if he and his aunt were to reach their final visit and be back for tea. Yet, at the same time, his aunt was in some fear of breaking the fresh eggs in their flannel-lined basket and of shaking the milk custard and the jellied beef tea into a puddled mess in their crocks. So he was fully occupied in picking the smoothest parts of the unmade road and in keeping the horse steady through a firm but gentle pressure on the reins. The trip might have been smoother and swifter if they had taken the car, but his aunt felt strongly that sick visiting was not the occasion for ostentation, and that she would not remind her poor but proud neighbours of their charity status by sweeping in with motor car and finery. Indeed, she wore a very plain dress and a beige linen driving duster, and her hat, which she kept for such visiting, was of plain straw and as modest in dimension as Cook's Sunday hat. Hugh wore a more formal suit, as befitted a representative of the medical profession. He had already visited today's patients with Dr. Lawton, and had been charged with following up on an informal basis as he accompanied his aunt on her rounds. As they bowled briskly around one of the few slight turns of the Military Canal Road, his eye caught sight of a female waving a large handkerchief from a roadside bench. He was poised to wave back as they drove by when his aunt startled him.
"Pull up, Hugh! Pull up!"
she said, tugging at his arm in a way that caused him to jerk at the horse's mouth and set the horse swerving towards the near-side ditch. Hauling the reins back, Hugh fought to draw the trap to a stop without causing the horse to plunge and rear.
"It's Beatrice Nash!" his aunt exclaimed. "I think she is in distress."
Hugh handed over the reins and leaped down to the road, heedless of the dust. As he hurried towards the bench, he found himself praying that Beatrice had not been attacked on the road. She was dishevelled and scratched, with blood on her neck and a large bruise on her arm. Her hair was tangled with thorns, and her skirt, he could see as he came close, was dark-stained and torn about the hem.
"Miss Nash?"
further inquiry stuck in his throat.
"I fell off my bicycle," she said. "Rather a nasty tumble into a ditch."
Hugh was careful to hide his relief. "Are you hurt?" he asked. Bones and blood he could bind up.
"My ankle," she said. "I don't think it's broken, but it took a blow. I was afraid if I took off my boot I would not be able to get it on again."
She smiled, but her face was pale, and he had an urge to gather her up like a bird with a broken wing. "I'm going to carry you to the trap," he said, "and once we have you settled, the boot needs to come off."
"I think I can hobble," she said, looking alarmed at his offer.
"I think not, given that the ankle is not yet examined," he said. Speaking with authority came easily to him in the cottages of farm labourers, but not so smoothly in the face of this young woman's sceptical gaze.
"Now, do be sensible," he begged.
As he hesitated, looking for the most efficient way to thrust an arm under her legs and another around her waist, she wrapped her skirt more closely about her legs to subdue its volume, and cleared her throat.
"I am not the tiniest of women to carry," she said.
"And I am not the world's strongest man," he said, "but I think I can manage to stagger a few yards."
With that he bent at the knees and gathered her up. The ribbing of her stays pressed into his flesh, and he could feel her back warm against his arm. She was not heavy as long as he pressed her close. He could feel her arms around his neck and smell the faint odour of soap under the more vivid scent of dirt and wildflowers. He resisted an unlikely urge to drop his head to her hair.
"My goodness, what on earth happened?" said his aunt as they approached the trap.
"Hurt an ankle," said Hugh.
His aunt gave him a sharp look, and he might have blushed, but he was fully engaged in trying to figure out how to help Beatrice into the rear bench seat of a trap that had never looked higher off the ground. It required at least 2 good feet to step up.
"Hold the horse steady, please."
"However will we manage?" asked Beatrice. "I think you'd better put me down."
"No, no," said Hugh. "Just be ready with your left foot. I'm going to step up and sort of launch you upwards."
He stared with grim focus at the small, smooth iron step, no bigger than a child's foot, which protruded from the rear of the trap, and tried not to think of them both falling hard into the road should the horse move at the wrong moment.
"It is times like these that one regrets not owning a landau," said Agatha. "Do be careful, Hugh."
"Yes, do be careful, Hugh," said Beatrice, and she was laughing, and Hugh was so delighted to hear her call him by his name that he almost lost his footing as he made the upward leap. In a rush of petticoats and a small squeak of pain, Beatrice was deposited on the hard bench, clutching for the railing as Hugh fell away and managed to land without twisting an ankle himself.
"I think we should push on to Little Hollow and get some cold spring water on that foot," said Agatha, looking back from the front seat. "Does it hurt much?"
"I'm not sure that's a good idea," said Hugh, who was now lashing the twisted bicycle to the rear of the trap with a spare leading rope. "They don't welcome strangers.
"On the contrary, Hugh," his aunt said, "I believe it would be taken as a sign of trust if we ask for help. This is our opportunity to show Maria Stokes that we value her knowledge."
"But do you wish to shock Miss Nash with such an encounter?" asked Hugh.
"Miss Nash is a well-travelled and stout-hearted woman, and will not go into hysterics over meeting a few gypsies," said his aunt. But Hugh, climbing up to take the reins, noticed she eyed Beatrice with care for any sign of distaste.
"No, indeed," said Beatrice.
She looked a little concerned, but not as much as he'd feared. Either she was an exceptional young woman, or she had faith in his aunt's good judgment. "On Wednesdays I do my sick visiting," said Agatha as the trap began to move again. "Dr. Lawton likes me to stop in quietly on some of his more delicate or difficult patients."
"He's saving them from the Ladies' Church Auxiliary," said Hugh. "He told me so, quite plainly."
"It's true that some cases are too delicate to receive the full delegation of ladies," said Agatha.
"But they do good work, and are not to be mocked, Hugh. Last summer, Mrs. Fothergill gave her prune jam to a dysentery patient, and nearly killed him," Hugh said with a laugh.
"It might have been the bedside lecture rather than the jam," said Agatha, in an equable tone. "But without such visits, many a sickly child would go without beef tea and milk pudding."
"My aunt is ever the diplomat," said Hugh. "When she knows you better, she will tell you tales to stand your hair on end."
"Dr. Lawton has been visiting old Maria Stokes for several years," said Agatha. "She is considered a healer among Romanies in the county, and Dr. Lawton sometimes asks me to bring her supplies. They don't trust most people."
"Dr. Lawton is the only doctor for miles who will come to them," said Hugh, "and none of the other ladies would stoop to visit."
The small clan of Romanies showed up reliably every summer to camp in Little Hollow and work the various harvests, beginning with strawberries and ending with the hops. Then they left as quietly as they came, and Hugh had often wondered why no one seemed to know what paths they took, or to what distant parts they travelled.
"The farmers could not do without their help," said Agatha, "but most of the town treats them like thieves and vagabonds."
"You do not think them thieves?" asked Beatrice.
"Dr. Lawton jokes that the Stokes' annual arrival is the start of the poaching season for locals," said Hugh. "He says when they start blaming a gypsy, you can be sure they have a rabbit stuffed down each trouser leg."
"Hugh," said Agatha, "there's no need to be crude."
"Sorry," said Hugh.
"The truth is that I would not leave my silver lying about when any stranger comes selling heather at the back door," said Agatha. "But they are no less Christian than Bettina Fothergill, and Maria Stokes is a particularly impressive woman. Were she not a Romany, she would have made a fine district nurse." Little Hollow was well hidden from the road by a slight fold in the cliffs from which the road turned away. Beatrice noticed that Hugh had some difficulty finding the narrow dirt path and coaxing the nervous horse between thick trees and undergrowth. In a small clearing, two lean dogs emerged barking from under a dark wooden caravan with a black tar roof. A shaggy horse, tethered to a long rope, looked sideways from one large eye, but did not bother to take his mouth from the long grass. The old woman sitting on the caravan steps was as wizened as a dried apple and, though the day was hot, was wrapped in several shawls. Yet her hands were swiftly stripping lavender buds from their stalks into her apron while her eyes, squinting from the smoke of a black pipe, met Beatrice's with a piercing stare. Nearby, an iron pot sat on a tripod above a small, smoky fire, and a small child slept on a straw pallet under a primitive tent of canvas draped over bent tree branches. Further down the path, a glimpse of another caravan roof and the smoke of another fire indicated others were nearby. Calling the dogs to heel by some strange word, the old woman carefully shook the contents of her apron into a basket and stepped forward to meet them as Hugh helped his aunt down from the trap.
"Good day, Mrs. Stokes," said Agatha. "How is the poor child?"
"Middlin' fair," said Mrs. Stokes. She looked pointedly up at Beatrice.
"Glad to hear it," said Agatha. "I have brought you some of my cook's best junket and some beef jelly.
Mrs. Stokes said nothing but continued to stare at Beatrice in silence.
"We rescued our young friend, Miss Nash, along our way," Agatha continued. Beatrice thought she detected a note of uncertainty in Agatha's voice, as if she were conscious that bringing Beatrice might undo some delicate relationship. "She fell off a bicycle and banged her ankle quite severely."
"We would be grateful for your assistance," said Hugh. "I want to get the swelling down, and we are far from home."
"Best be setting her down, then," said Mrs. Stokes.
She pointed at a fallen log set beside the caravan. It was covered with a thin cotton rag rug, the colours almost washed and beaten out of it.
"I'll have the boy see to the horse."
With that, she set off towards her caravan without a backward glance. Agatha was left to hoist the baskets of food, and Beatrice had to submit once again to the less than dignified operation of being lifted down from the trap and carried by Hugh. The ankle's throb had merged into a continuous ache, and Beatrice felt her boot like a vice squeezing at the leg. She sat down and bent to undo the long rows of laces, but her ankle was so swollen that the pressure of her fingers on the tight knot made her flinch.
"It hurts," she whispered.
"The boot needs to come off," said Hugh.
"Aunt Agatha, hold her comfortably, please, and I'll do it."
Agatha sat on the log beside her, and Beatrice felt the pressure of her enfolding arms.
"I've got you," she said,
as Beatrice turned her face like a child into Agatha's broad bosom. She could not hold back a sudden welling of tears. She could only hope they would think it from the pain, and not the exquisite and almost forgotten sensation of being held. It had been so long since her father's last embrace, reduced to a tentative stroking of her hair, his hands papery and blue-veined. In the months since his death, she now understood. She had enjoyed no human touch beyond the occasional shaking of gloved hands. Agatha supported her while Hugh, with no thought for his clothes, sat cross-legged on the ground and took her foot gently across his lap, stripping off his driving gloves to work the stubborn leather laces through their tiny brass grommets. Beatrice felt pain and then relief as inch by inch the boot released its grip from her flesh.
"I'm going to manipulate the foot now to make sure it is not broken," said Hugh.
His voice was low and kind. She could feel his warm fingers through her thin lisle stockings, pressing gently as he moved her foot slowly in multiple directions.
"I don't think it's broken."
"We'll be needing to get that stocking off,"
said Maria Stokes, coming back with a boy who carried two large buckets of water on a yoke as if they weighed nothing. The lean dogs gave him a raucous welcome, and Beatrice recognized, with some shock, that it was Snout, the boy she was to tutor. He seemed not at all pleased to see her. He set down the buckets hard enough to make the water slop.
"I'll want to look at the bruise before we bind it up," said Hugh.
"I'm sure you will,"
said Maria Stokes, in a way that made young Snout grin and Hugh Grange turn red.
"Well, perhaps if Snout will see to the horse, I should check on the child," said Hugh.
He handed the boy a coin, and Snout whistled to the dogs and slopped away to the trap with one of the buckets. Beatrice soaked her foot in the cold spring water and drank strong hot tea out of a porcelain cup and saucer, which, though of florid design, were edged thickly with gold and obviously costly. Maria Stokes preferred to drink from a large tin mug she kept at her belt. When the tea was done, the ankle was examined in Maria Stokes's rough hands and pronounced to be only badly bruised.
"I've got a salve for that, if you care to take it," she said.
"Oh, I'm sure," began Beatrice.
"That would be most kind," said Hugh, as he returned to them and peered at the ankle from a respectable distance. "Mrs. Stokes is famous for her remedies."
And so Maria Stokes produced from her caravan a small wax-sealed jar of a thick, pine-scented salve, spread it liberally on Beatrice's rapidly darkening bruise, and covered it in tidy fashion with rough strips of linen bandage.
"It's quite pungent," said Hugh, who peered with a frown of professional interest at Maria's ministrations. "Do I smell rosemary?"
"Maybe you do," said Maria.
"Be sure to use it dawn and dusk," she added to Beatrice.
"For how long?" asked Beatrice.
"When the jar be empty, you'd best stop," said Maria.
"And it'd be good luck to return the jar with something in it."
"Thank you," said Beatrice.
"How do you find the babe?" Maria asked Hugh.
"Much improved," he said. "The lungs sound quite clear now. I think with rest and careful diet, he'll be running around in a week."
"Thank you," she said. "I'm afeard of nothing except when the children get the fever in the lungs. Then I go all to pieces with worry. Tell the doctor I'm grateful he came out."
"I will. And thank ye, ma'am, for coming," she added, pressing Agatha's hands. "Precious few ladies would put themselves out for a child of ours. And us don't forget."
"We must thank you for helping our young friend," said Agatha.
"The boy can go back with you and take the machine to his father if you like, miss," said Maria.
"Oh, I'm sure it's too much bother," said Beatrice, in a hasty manner she hoped would not betray her reluctance.
"No trouble, miss," said Snout. "Barskull is going to need some hammering out, and a new chain.
Save him a long walk if you've no objection to my great-grandson on your step," added Mrs. Stokes.
"That's settled, then," said Agatha smoothly. "Mr. Sidley is the very best in all mechanical repairs." The rooftops of Rye were ahead of them, the sun indicating the lateness of the afternoon, and Beatrice's head nodding with exhaustion when Hugh stopped the trap in a small turning before the river. Snout hopped down from his precarious perch on the rear step and untied the bicycle.
"I'll bring it when I come for me lesson, miss," he said, and paused before asking. "No reason Artie and Jack got to know anything about it, though."
"Silentium est aureum," she said. He was surprised into a grin, by which she knew he had understood her promise to be silent. He tugged at his cap and wheeled the bicycle away. As Hugh flicked the horse on, Agatha turned to Beatrice and shook her arm. "I think you'd better come home with us," she said. "We have hot water for a bath, and Jenny to help you. You have some cuts and scrapes that should be swabbed with iodine."
"I'll be fine," said Beatrice. "I'm sure Mrs. Turber can spare me a kettle of hot water."
"In case you haven't met my aunt, I don't think her invitation was optional," Hugh advised with a laugh.
Beatrice felt she should further protest, but the thought of Agatha's gleaming white bathtub, the soft bed in the blue room, and a freshly cooked hot dinner seemed irresistible after such an exhausting day, and so she agreed with the politest of thanks. They pulled into the driveway, laughing over the pungency of Mrs. Stokes's salve, and Hugh's insistence that she also offered love potions, and claimed she could poison a pig without ruining the meat, but said she never would. The front door stood companionably open, and a pleasant-looking man in shirt-sleeves and tie was somewhat incongruously admiring the front gardens while smoking a cigarette.
"John, whatever are you doing home?" called Agatha. As the horse pulled to a standstill, he stepped to hand her down from the trap, and they embraced as if young lovers, he swinging her off her feet while she clutched for her hat.
"Do put me down for shame," she said. "You will throw out your back again."
"It would be worth it as ever," he said, "but I will settle for a kiss."
She kissed him on his graying sideburns, and he kissed her back, and then he was shaking Hugh's hand.
"And this is Beatrice, whom you met in London, who has fallen from her bicycle," said Agatha,
and Beatrice found herself given a hearty handshake by John Kent.
"Do you need a hand to get her down, my boy?"
said John, but Hugh assured him he did not.
"I think we have this down to an art now," he said,
and Beatrice subjected herself once more to being lifted from the trap and carried into Agatha's front hall.
"It is so good to be home, and to worry about something real, such as a lovely young woman's injured ankle and the fact that cook is not happy to have had no notice about dinner," said John Kent, following them inside. "I swear it gives one faith that England will always stand."
He was smiling, but he rubbed his temple as if a very tired man.
"Why, John, it's not like you to wax lyrical in the middle of the afternoon," said Agatha, taking off her hat and tossing it on a peg. "Whatever can be the matter?"
"I'm just grateful to be home," said John Kent, catching his wife by the waist and kissing her again on the cheek in a very firm manner. "You have no idea how grateful."
Hugh slowly let Beatrice down and held her arm as she balanced as little weight as possible on her bad foot. She was grateful once again for the pressure of his touch, as John Kent looked gravely into his wife's face.
What Uncle John is trying to say is that home in England may not stand always, said Daniel, leaning against the drawing-room doorway, a large glass held in his hand and his tie unacceptably askew. So, we are drinking to them now.
Why is Daniel drinking whiskey so early? Asked Agatha.
Is there bad news from London? Asked Hugh.
I'm afraid so, said his uncle.
He caught Agatha's two hands in his and held them to his lips.
Germany has invaded Belgium, he said. Tomorrow, we will be at war.
Agatha Kent tucked a strand of hair back into its roll and wondered if she should call Jenny to come and fix her hair more tightly. But she had declared that they were not dressing for dinner. John was exhausted, and while a note had been sent to Mrs. Turbers to bring fresh clothes for Beatrice, Agatha thought it easier not to request evening dress. She added a small hairpin, decorated with an emerald turtle, to the wayward hair and smoothed down the clean blouse she had added, happy not to have to exchange her loose stays for an evening corset. She always enjoyed the peaceful half hour before the sound of the dinner gong, and at her dressing table, the evening light coming in the window and the companionable sounds of John changing his shirt in his dressing room next door, it was easy to believe for a moment that this evening was no different, that John had not come home for such a brief visit, and to give them such terrible news.
"Can you help me with this damned cufflink?" he said,
wandering in with his shirt untucked and his feet in his favourite Moroccan slippers. He sat comfortably on the end of the bed and held out his arm. Agatha turned around on her dressing stool to oblige, and while she struggled with the stiff cuff, John sighed deeply and leaned his head forward onto her shoulder, tucking his cheek against her neck. Securing the cufflink, Agatha placed her hand on his back, and they sat a moment in an embrace of silent, mutual comfort, which was, she often thought, the reward of those long married.
"We thought the Kaiser would compel Austria to show restraint in the East," he said. "Instead, they are turning on France. They are already in Luxembourg, and tomorrow they will rip apart Belgian neutrality."
"You have done all you could, I'm sure," said Agatha.
"We have been caught flat-footed by Berlin," he said, raising his head and running a hand over his hair in weary frustration. "And as we refuse, above all else, to look publicly foolish, I fear they have left us no room to remain outside the conflict."
"It does seem unimaginable that we would be enemies," said Agatha.
"What is Emily Wheaton's daughter to do? Her husband is such a lovely young man."
"If she wishes to join him, she should leave immediately," said John, standing up to use Agatha's dressing-table mirror as he knotted his blue-spotted bow tie. "Travel will soon be impossible.